So, it's my great pleasure to introduce Laureate Professor Peter Doherty. Born in Brisbane, Peter's career has included long stints in Edinburgh, Canberra, Memphis, and Melbourne. He now works between St. Jude's Research Hospital in Memphis, where he holds the Michael F. Tamer Chair, and the Doherty Institute at the University of Melbourne, where he is Laureate Professor. Peter and his colleague, Rolf Zinkernagel, were awarded the 1996 Nobel Prize for their work on how the immune system recognises virus-ridden cells. The Australian Academy of Sciences describes this as, quote, one of the most profound discoveries of the last 50 years in the burgeoning field of immunology. And it has served as a basis for medicines and vaccines for infectious diseases, inflammatory diseases, and also cancers. In addition to sharing with Professor Zinkernagel the Paul Ehrlich Prize, the Gairdner International Prize, and the Lasker Award for Basic Science, Peter is the recipient of over 20 honorary doctorates and has been elected to numerous academies of science and medicine. In 2005, Peter added a new trajectory to his career with the publication of The Beginner's Guide to Winning the Nobel Prize. The first of six non-fictive works that include the wonderfully titled Sentinel Chickens, What Birds Tell Us About Our Health and the World, The Knowledge Wars from 2015, and most recently, The Incidental Tourist, a book of scientific travels. The desire to refute current political caricatures of how scientific investigation, debate, and consensus actually work is a key theme to these books, which evince a clear-headed insistence that we think through the realities of anthropogenic climate change, among other pressing issues. But there is also a delightful openness and play to Peter's prose, as when he suggests in the opening pages of A Light History of Hot Air that the reader, daunted by the various chemical symbols dotting the text, might think of him or herself as, quote, a kind of anthropologist who is trying to gain some glimpses of a different and silent culture by reading the glyphs and runes written in the language C, H, O, and N, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. So we are introduced to the different, enormously powerful, and yet in some ways still curiously silent culture of modern science. Please join me in welcoming Professor Peter Doherty.
Thanks, Paul. I'll ramble on for 15 minutes with somewhat disorganised thoughts and just pull me off the stage if I go on too long, because the problem with geriatric Nobel Prize winners is we never know when to shut up, as my wife tells me frequently. So basically, we're talking about science. Let's just say what we're talking about with science. When we're talking about writing in science, we're talking about modern science, which goes back to the 17th century, basically. We're not talking about, I mean, people talk about science in the indigenous sense or the science of ancient China. This, what we're really talking about here is trial and error and people recognizing what succeeds and then proceeding with that. And that's not to say it's not powerful, and of course it is a discovery, but it's not what we're thinking about in modern science. Modern science really begins in the 17th century with a movement across Europe, which is, I guess, associated with the Reformation, Renaissance, all that sort of period, where people started, rather than taking things on faith and instruction and dogma from famous people like Galen, the physician who lived at the back in the time of Christ, more or less, and then just following that dogma, they started to turn back again and look at reality, look at the thing itself. And that's what modern science is about, looking at the thing itself. And this really started, in Britain, it starts really with Francis Bacon, former Chancellor of the Exchequer under James I, I think, and who was discredited, but then turned his gaze to what we call natural philosophy. The term scientist doesn't exist until the mid-19th century. Scientists like Newton describe themselves as natural philosophers. But what Bacon said, essentially, is we have to look at the thing itself. And this is the basis of scientific observation, scientific discovery. And we have to formalise that process. We have to make measurement. Measurement is absolutely essential. And then after we've made those measurements, we've come to those conclusions, then it must be written up and published so that others can repeat what we've done or can know what we've done, think about it and take it on to the next stage. And that's how modern science works. Writing is absolute, and reporting are absolutely central to it. But as you say, it's a reporting process that most of us think happens with this. Now, when it comes, and I've written about this, and I've written about the form of the scientific paper in my 2015 book, The Knowledge Wars, and peer review, and all those things. So if you're interested in it, get it out of the library. I do get 10 cents or something every time it's taken out of the library, I think. No one expects you to buy this thing. But it is in there. There's some appendices that talk about the modern scientific paper. Now, so how does this writing process work? Well, it has to be published. If you're interested in the history of scientific publication, the very first scientific journal in the English language is the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London. The Royal Society of London was chartered by Charles II. It's the first academy of science. And of course, science was a very broad church back then. We had people like Christopher Wren and Samuel Pepys and those guys were all members of the Royal Society. Now you have to get elected to it. You have to be a very successful scientist and all the rest of it. It also serves as the British Commonwealth Academy of Science. And the Shine Dome just down here, of course, is the Australian Academy of Science, which was started by the Australian Fellows of the Royal Society under much the same principles. Now, the Philosophical Transactions, published since, I think, about 1646 or 1650 or something, are all online, they're all digitized, and you can read them. You can go back and read the works of Hooke and Leeuwenhoek and Newton and all those things in their original writing. They've all got these funny S's or whatever, you know, all that stuff. It's kind of intriguing to read this stuff. So the writing process, the discovery process in science. Well, first, the discovery process in science really comes from designing, having a hypothesis and either making measurements, as the climate scientists do. They're mainly about measuring things and recording measurements. And it comes from often doing experiments, which is what Yvonne and I have done most of our life. We are experimental scientists. We work in labs, and that's the way most biomedical research is done. There is a strong theoretical component in physics. Physics divides itself into theoreticians and into experimentalists. We don't do that in biology, and the reason for that is that it doesn't work. What science is ultimately pragmatic, and we do what works. And physics, because physics obeys the laws of physics, which are pretty immutable. I mean, people talk about the laws of economics. There are no laws of economics, just practices and fantasies. I'm insulting all the economists in the audience. Neoliberal fantasy economics. But there are laws of physics. Biology obeys those laws of physics and chemistry at the micro level, but actual biology itself is much more chaotic because it's worked by evolution. We build structures on pre-existing structures. We don't build them on basic things. So it's much more chaotic, and it doesn't lead itself very much to theory. We do write hypotheses, as you'll see, I think, later. So how the process of writing. So firstly, discovery, and whether you're going to discover something, will depend to some extent on how well you design your experiment, what the hypothesis underlying your experiment may be. Are you looking at the right parameters? Are you measuring the right things? Are you doing it competent technically, a competent technical job? Do you have people in the lab? It's years since we did much in the lab who have what we call green fingers. Will the whole thing work? But the real process of discovery that comes with writing comes at a later stage. And that comes when you assemble that data together, all those results in figures and tables and graphs and all sorts of things, in some sort of logical form. And then you sit down with that data and you try to see what that is telling you. And really good scientists, the people that make big discoveries, are, to my mind, the people that can clear that. It's like you said about the poet. It's people that can take out all the preconceptions. They can be aware of what the thinking is in the field, what other people have thought, what other people have said, but they have to be prepared to set those aside completely where necessary. Go back to the data, the information in front of you, the numbers, the figures, the graphs, and be instructed by that information. They'd have to be prepared to be instructed by nature. And that's where the discovery process that involves writing happens. As you try to sort out intellectually what it is that this is actually telling you. Now, that what that ends up doing actually, in any where you're making discovery particularly, is to make the scientific paper that we read in some senses a fraud. It's not a fraud in the sense that it's lying because you're working from the data, but it's in sense that it's a scientific paper is written in a very formalized way. You have a short abstract which sort of tells you what it's about and hopefully hooks people into what are reading it. You then have an introduction which supposedly says why you did what you did. You then have the results, which are the data, which is the core to it. And then you have a discussion where you talk about what it may mean and so forth. And then you have a method section because people have to be able to repeat what you've done and they have to know exactly how you did it. So, but where it's to some extent fraudulent, and this was pointed out much before I said so by Peter Medawar, is that you write the paper from the results you had, not from what you thought you were looking at in the first place, because the two things would be rather different. And if you wrote down your thought process and intellectual processes that led to this set of results, you would raise immediate questions in the minds of all reviewers. You would confuse them, because all scientific writing is peer-reviewed anonymously, and you would not get your paper published. Now, philosophers hate that. They want us to say how we got there, how we went through our thought process, what happened, and all the rest of it. But that's not the way a scientific paper is written. So that's what you've got in a scientific paper. And the creative people, the really smart people in science, are the ones often who ask, you can sometimes pick them, when you're giving a talk, they will ask questions that seem incredibly naive. But it's often the naive question is the big question that hasn't been answered. And you can get it with kids too. The worst audience to talk to is an audience of 12 or 13 years old. 5-year-olds, they'll ask you weird things. You'll be talking about immunity and they'll ask you about crocodile skin, so that's not very useful. But it's often those kids, they've learned about this, but they've got a big question in their head. And sometimes we lose sight of the big questions. So that's scientific writing as a discovery process. And I think the writing part is essential to discovery. And I also think one of the real problems with young scientists as things stand is a lot of people in the sciences have not had much affection for the language. It's not what they naturally gravitate towards. That's why they're ending up in a lab, one of the reasons. They, I think, are intimidated often by the writing process. And quite frankly, it's difficult to see if you can't put things logically and rationally together in a written form. I find it, I'm not never quite sure whether they can think clearly about what they're doing. Now, scientific thinking is not just in words. I mean, some of the most creative scientists actually think in terms of, they visualize, they think in terms of structure. Francis Crick, who was the co-discoverer of built that model with Jim Watson of the DNA, the double helix, which changed biology really, was his capacity that was unique. He was a very smart man, very critically minded man, but his capacity, he even had a fantastic capacity to visualize the structure. A lot of that now is done on computers. That wasn't available at the time. They also, when they wrote their initial thing, there's just one or two sentences at the end which state the enormous significance of what they discovered, which is how we reproduce, replicate, really, and pass on our DNA. And there's just one or two sentences at the end which begin with the statement, "It has not escaped our attention that." That is a typical scientific writing thing. We don't say, we've discovered this and this is true. We say, it is possible that, or the best interpretation of this data is that. And so that's why scientific reporting is always nuanced. That's what politicians hate about us, particularly, and journalists and all the rest of it, because they can't get it. They're used to dogma. They want definite statements. They're religious people, and we're not religious people. We don't do dogma. If we do, we're losers. And there are a lot of bad people in science. I mean, you know, a lot of people are not very smart, shall we say. Should I say that, Yvonne? That's true. Well, you know, the science itself works at all sorts of levels. Some people are very good in the lab. They're very good technically. Some are very good managerially. And some are very good at the development end of science, where you're actually trying to take a discovery and make it into a product. So there's all sorts of types of personalities and people in science. The modern scientific lab is broad. I mean, there's a lot of people in it. And actually, I think one of the things that attracts young people to science, they do a little bit of science and they think, oh, I love science. One of the things that attracts them is they've often been at school, and if they weren't very good at sport and they're focused on ideas and nature, they're kind of nerdy in the school culture. They then get to a university, they spend a bit of time in the lab, they find a lot of people like them, but it's also a very nice community. And a lab that runs well is a very collegial, pleasant community of people, which is particularly supportive in all sorts of ways. And so being in a scientific lab, that's often very important, particularly to young scientists. And now, of course, we're going to talk about a scientific paper I wrote a very, very long time ago, but the scientific paper now is very different from that type of paper that we wrote then, because science back 50 years ago was still being done by rather small groups of people or a few people working together. Now it's often done in medical science by very big teams, 15, 20 people on a research paper. And in actual fact, when a senior scientist like me, when I actually get to see the data, it's often the first time I've seen it all together from different types of perspectives and technologies. And that's often the only time I would really get an overview of what's going on. So mostly when I'm writing now, I'm looking at research papers that have been written by more junior people, and they come up to me and I'm looking at the thing, and I've got a horrible tendency to rewrite everything and put it in my own form of English. But I think that's often when I really focus on what's there. So when I tell young scientists how to write a scientific paper, I say, what you must do is, as you're doing your experiments, you must pull the data together and start to look at it and commune with your data. Commune with your data, love your data, live with your data, forget about all this relationship stuff and, you know, spouse and all that sort of thing, push those aside. Data is what drives your life. Of course, they don't take my advice. The other advice I always give them is marry a rich banker or a lawyer, and they usually don't do that either. But and when you look at some of the bankers, probably a good thing. But but it's that focus on the data, and the other thing about a modern scientific paper is it. Whereas when I started writing 50 years ago, I knew the whole field pretty much because it was very small. But now we've got so many different technologies, so many different types of expertise. On a scientific paper, you'll have people ranging from people trained in biology, chemistry, statistics. We call them computational biologists. They're basically modelers. And it's really everything is on trust, because there'll be no one person on that scientific paper who understands in depth everything that's happening in those particular analyses. So science depends totally on trust, which is why when we get fraud in science, it's such a profound betrayal of the scientific process. And fraud in science, by the way, it tends to be in the medical sciences, which are often you have people with conflicted motives trying to develop a cure rather than being instructed by the data, for instance, can be a problem. And the social sciences. Fraud in for instance, climate science, which people like you to think would be happening, is almost impossible. They're big groups, all highly trained mathematicians, physicists, and absolutely straight, actually, because they're not conflicted in some way by the desire to save lives or whatever, which you know, obviously is a great motivation for medical science. But when you take your your discovery and your finding beyond what the data tells you, and you think you're going to apply that, we can get into real problems. And we've killed people at times because that has happened. An over-enthusiasm, nothing malevolent about it, but simply an over-enthusiasm. So how have I gone for time?
Maybe a couple more minutes, if you
want to. I've got a few more notes. A lot of that, a lot of what makes scientists particularly impatient with the political process and with processes in general is that everything tends to be organised in silos. I mean, you don't have to know that. If you work in a university, this is basically an attempt to break down some silos, isn't it? What we talk about cross-disciplinary. What makes scientists, in a sense, often very ineffective in the political sense, is that we're used to breaking that down to the basics and building up from the basics. That's almost impossible in most of our public institutions. They're built on one structure, built on another structure, built on another structure. So it's like evolution, if you like. If you want an example of an ensiloed culture, you couldn't get anything better than our federal government. The silos are called ministries, and it's almost impossible to make. For instance, if you get a health treatment, which is very expensive, you look at it as health cost, but you don't look at it as a welfare saving cost if you don't have to pay out money to people who are unable to work. I mean, it's not necessarily the way the thing works, but it really should. And we should be able to break everything back down to basics and look at the total implications of it. A modern scientific paper, if you try to pick up the journal Nature and read a scientific paper as someone who's outside the field, you would find it almost impossible. In fact, they're almost impossible for people in the field. And the reason for that is now these are very prestigious journals. They only publish what's fashionable, for a start. And the other thing is that the peer review process is so... goes on and on and on. And though the scientific manuscript that's submitted to the editors may be clearly written with a clear conceptual framework, by the time it's been through several rounds of review, the authors have responded trying to get the reviewer's comments worked in. And they're not going to contradict them because it's a big deal to get published in Nature and it helps your career a lot. What you will end up with is a turgid, incomprehensible morass. And I can't read most of the papers in my field and make sense of them. But you can sort of see what they're on about, but they're awful. And the writing is awful. You get a lot of much better writing in a lot of the sort of trade journals of the particular scientific societies, like the Journal of Virology or Journal of Immunology. And what happens then at the level of, say, Nature or Science is they have someone probably trained as a scientist, but one of the relatively rare young scientists who really loves writing, who's made a transition into becoming involved with scientific journals and so forth. And they like writing, and they will take this information thing and turn it into what we call a news and views. So grab hold of a copy of the journal Nature next time you're in the library, and you'll see, firstly, the scientific papers, which can be very, very tough reading, but then you will see at the front of it a number of sort of commentaries, news and views, which will summarise what's being done here, how it fits in the field. And if you want to relate to science, in a sense, and you're not in the science, and that's the way I relate to most science outside my field, that's where you look. The other thing in the back of Nature now, they sometimes have a little bit of creative writing, a page, a little sort of short story thing. And some of the scientific journals now actually publish short stories, essentially, written around the discipline. Our younger son, Michael, is a neurologist who writes. He mainly writes trout fishing fiction. but he also writes neurology fiction, which is published in the Journal of Neurology. They actually do a little bit of fiction. I must say we find the trout fishing fiction much easier to read. So there are some people in there in the scientists who have a tendency towards fiction. But generally, if you've been writing science for decades, creative writing is not something we go for. We don't make stuff up, or we shouldn't. And if we do, we shouldn't be doing science. I did try a novel, but it was so appalling that it never got past my my agent. I thought the world was ready for a Jane Austen climate change murder mystery, but maybe not. I had no idea how to finish it. I mean, it was hopeless.
Please join me in thanking Peter.